Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Our country needs to be protected, arguably, most urgently, from an enemy foreign with considerable tentacles domestic as well. That would be, of course, the Chinese Communist Party. That is the subject of many of our conversations here at Securing America, and properly so. The best of them, arguably, are the ones we have with our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man with extensive experience both in uniform and as a foreign service officer, as a senior business executive, and now as a denizen of the think tank space, including our own Center for Security Policy, I'm pleased to say. Much of that time spent in East Asia and monitoring, contending with, and warning about the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP. In fact, he has a brand new book out, which I will ask him to hold up at the moment. It is entitled, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel, I know it's not quite out. It's about to be published. Congratulations on it. I'm looking forward to having a chance to talk with you about it at some length today. But give us a glimpse of the cover, if you would.
Sure, I'll be glad to. Okay. Here it is.
When China Attacks. And the issue that I think it very nicely addresses in the opening bid is, it's not a matter of if, it is a matter of when. We're talking with you, of course, just as the two arguably leading despots of the world, the Chinese Communist Party's newly anointed emperor, Xi Jinping, and his vassal, a much junior partner in this so-called No Limits Partnership, Vladimir Putin, have been meeting in Moscow and have come up with, it appears, some new understandings between the two of them. Give us a sense of the context, if you would, especially against the backdrop of your new book, and what their conversations likely portend for the rest of us.
Well, what you saw was the Chinese really giving the seal of approval to Vladimir Putin and the Russians for what they've done, what they're doing, their invasion of Ukraine. This was really a sort of poke in the eye to the West, to the free nations on the part of Beijing. This shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone. Before Putin invaded Ukraine, as you will recall, the Russians and the Chinese signed something called the No Limits Partnership, No Limits Friendship, what have you. And it was a long statement. And basically, each side said it was going to fully support the other one. But one of the key lines in it was that it implied and strongly suggested that, and this was the interpretation on the part of Chinese officials, that they would keep their mouths shut about what Putin did in Ukraine, tacitly support it, and under the table give it a lot of support, and even over the table give it a lot of support, because in exchange, when the time came that China was going to settle the Taiwan issue once and for all, they were going to get Russian help, and Russia was going to return the favor. So there was really nothing in any of these meetings held just the other day between Putin and Xi that was constructive in the least, or that was different from anything we already knew, that China was going to fully back Russia, and when the time came, Russia would return the favor. Of course, there's been plenty of people sort of grasping at straws, thinking that somehow there was so much animosity between the Chinese and the Russians that they weren't really serious about what they were doing, that Xi was going to, in fact, put the Russians in a more difficult position. Well, that time may come sometime in the future, but for now, their strategic interests align, and that is both countries hate the United States, want to dominate and or destroy the U.S., and are cooperating to do it. And they're working along with sort of an alliance of thugocracies and dictatorships, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and some others will sign up at some point if it looks like these guys are on a roll. And that is where we are. But the Chinese, of course, are trying to be a little bit coy, mostly so that they can give the apologists, the accommodationists, and really the not naive people an opportunity to think, well, the Chinese aren't really giving wholehearted support. And if we don't pressure China on anything else they do, well, maybe they won't be too overt about it, too active, too aggressive at all. That is, to put it mildly, wishful thinking. We're seeing an alignment of two really, for all their problems, very powerful dictatorships that are aligning to cause us ill. And this is something we've seen before. You know, I wish there were more people around who were 120 years old, because they could tell you this looks really familiar.
We have seen this movie before, and it ends, well, I guess in the past it has ended on a not so bad note, but boy, there was a lot of rough country in between. Grant, the term that the People's Daily has picked up on in its headline reporting on this summitry is that Xi and Putin agree to deepen, quote, comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination for a new era. That sounds to me a lot like the kind of coordination that was going on when they unveiled the No Limits Partnership in the first place, on the margins of the, well, we called them genocide games, the Olympics, back in February of last year. And wouldn't you know it, one of the first fruits of that strategic partnership was a clearly green-lighted invasion of Ukraine. And as you say, it may be that the, you know, Xi and his team are banking chits with Putin for their own activities. Do you think there's a decent chance that this particular summit and this new formulation of strategic cooperation is likely to mean, in practical terms, that Putin has now green-lighted Xi's attack, which you forecast in your new book, is a matter of when, not if?
Yes, I wouldn't rule that out. I think there's really nothing that I've seen in the dealings between Russia and China which would suggest otherwise. And the questions you note is when. And if you want to address that now, I would suggest the key point, key time to watch out for is Taiwan's presidential election that is coming in early 2024. If a pro-China candidate, and there will be one running, if he wins, then China may just think it has a very good chance of having their proxy sort of pull Taiwan into China's embrace and through political warfare get what they want. And thus there's no need, would be no need to fight.
Win without fighting, as Sun Tzu famously said.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they want to do. And they do have a shot at it. You know, one has to realize that Taiwanese domestic politics is just about as important as the defense alignments, the defense balance between both sides, between all sides. But there's also an option, and that is if the candidate from the party that wants nothing to do with Chinese domination and just wants to stay like they are, which essentially is free, and if that person wins at that point, I think China's probably going to be very sorely tempted to, as they say these days, go kinetic, which means attack and start shooting and attack. And so that's early 2024 to me. Is a very significant date. That's how I would read it.
And that's, of course, in the run-up to, but before the U.S. election. Presumably Joe Biden remains the president of the United States. And the Chinese have certainly taken his measure by some accounts, including that of our friend and colleague at the Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you are an important member as well, as a controlled asset of China. We'll come back to that and more right after this with Grant Newsom. Yeah. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're speaking with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, one of our duty experts, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. He is a man of many parts and now an author of an important new book. It is available for pre-order, and I commend it to you. It is entitled When China Attacks, A Warning to America. And Grant, you were just beginning to give us a texture of what an attack by China might look like in the event that they feel they do have to go kinetic because things don't work out for them in the upcoming presidential election in Taiwan. And before we get into some of the details of all of that, just again, a bit more context. As I understand it, a leader of the Kuomintang Party, which is the one that has, despite its history as the, you know, opponent of the Chinese Communists that moved in the aftermath of losing in the revolution to Taiwan, it is now the party that seems to be most enthralled with becoming part of China, becoming at least subordinate to the Chinese Communist Party. This is not, I take it, the candidate likely to be on the ticket, but a leader of his party, is that right?
Well, he's a prominent figure. He was a former president of Taiwan, in fact, around the 2010 time and after that. And he has always been suspicious. And it's generally believed that he really wasn't trying to defend Taiwan. And he's always been considered somewhat slippery, but I think
a running
it's fair...
dog of the Chinese Communist Party, one might say.
Oh, I would say a toady, a stooge, if I was going to use the Chinese, the communist language. And so there's some real concern that he represents what a KMT candidate would do, and this is not good to have. Ma, that's his name, and he's now. Either in China or going there very shortly on a tour. And there's some talk that he actually hopes to be named governor of newly annexed Taiwan, or else as a special advisor on Taiwan affairs for Xi Jinping. That's how bad it is. So Taiwanese domestic politics really is important to watch. Chinese subversion of Taiwan and its political class, its society, has been ongoing for decades, and it's as bad as it is in the United States, maybe even a little worse because it's an easier target for the communists. But the other thing the Chinese will look at is the U.S. situation, and they will look at the stability in the United States, whether we've got riots in the streets like we did last time when we had an election, look at our financial condition, political condition, and they will look at the nature of the administration and the people in the White House. That's what they always do. And they may not be too frightened by what they see.
Well, worse yet, I would argue, having run the playbook before, they will be contributing to instability. They will be waging political warfare mm-hmm. against us. One of the crimes we've talked about in a forthcoming book as well, titled The Indictment, and we'll be talking more about that in the days to come. But clearly part of the unrestricted warfare, as you know so well, Colonel, that they've been engaged in against us, to say nothing of the Taiwanese, is of a political character and fomenting fault lines between our people and promoting agendas of, you know, undermining the family and of course, confidence in the government, the rule of law, and so on. All of this is right out of that sort of cultural Marxist game plan, is it not?
It is. They both support those efforts and they egg them on. And I touch on this in the book, but this has been going on for a long time. It's just that it's really reached a point at which it is rocking the foundations of our country. And this is, to the Chinese, they are at war. What you're talking about is very much a form of warfare. It's just not one that we recognize as war, but we need to.
Yeah. Well, and you were a participant in our Team B3 study as well, another important book entitled The CCP is at War with America. And I think it makes the case that we should be under no illusion that this is an ongoing campaign against our country and possibly may go to a whole new level, depending on how, you know, China decides to play its hand. Grant, just to go back to Ma for a moment, this former president of Taiwan. Am I right in recollecting that during his time in office, he did a lot to try to integrate Taiwan's economy with the mainland, notably investing large amounts of money in China from Taiwan and vice versa.
That's true. And it was the vice versa that was the big thing. He was effectively going to open up Taiwan to Chinese economic an invasion. And you're going to see masses of Chinese coming into Taiwan to do business, tourism, etc. And the idea was just to swamp Taiwan so it wouldn't even be in a position to resist. And he almost succeeded. That's the thing that, you know, we tend to forget because we have short attention spans as we're human beings. But around, 2014, 2015, he was well on the way to getting this done. And it was a spontaneous almost revolution or protest led by students, led by young Taiwanese that forced him to back off. And that ultimately
the enslavement of China.
You know, yeah. That's just it. You know, but it was that small group of people who, you know, made it stop. And it led to a popular sort of outcry against what Ma was trying to do and a recognition of what the results would be if he did it. But they were so close. And what happened is that Ma had to back off. And then the next election, the opposition party won. And say these people,
which
want
is very
nothing.
Much a pro Taiwanese, well, I don't know if it's independence exactly, but certainly not becoming an adjunct of the Chinese Communist state. And you know what's so key about this, and I'm so glad you mentioned it, Colonel. I mean, it's something the Marines have always, of course, understood. A few good men, or men and women, for that matter, can make all the difference. It's something that I think, as we look at the challenges that we're facing domestically, among other things, in this country, it's often hard to appreciate what I guess in the Bible it talks about as the remnant, the difference, even relatively small numbers of people who are, well, determined, who are committed, and who are willing to put it all on the line, as our founders did, of course, with their sacred honor, have things come out differently than is otherwise the plan, certainly that of the Marxists amongst us as well as overseas. So I just wanted to emphasize this point. A small number of people in Taiwan made a difference in the trajectory of their country and may yet do so again. And I think that's a message that we really need to keep in mind as we sometimes are discouraged here, don't you think?
No, definitely. If you look at the actual numbers of people who led, it was called the, I think, the Sunflower Revolution. Those protests, Sunflower protests, not a very big number, but it resonated very quickly, and the ripple effects were obviously big enough to get this guy that was selling out his country, force him to back off. And it, so that your point is well taken. It, of course, also works in the opposite direction, where a fairly small group of aggressive, malicious people can take a free country where it doesn't, most people don't want to go.
That's so true. And especially, I think that other adjective that bears on it is if they're ruthless, as well as determined and, you know, making concerted action. Grant Newsom, we're going to talk more about ruthless, possibly kinetic action by the Chinese Communist Party against Taiwan and perhaps our own assets, personnel, and territory as well. That and more with Colonel Grant Newsom right after this short break. Stay tuned. You're not going to want to miss it.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back for a continuation of our hour-long conversation with the author of a brand new book, so new it's not quite out, but it is available for pre-order. It's called When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Its author is Colonel Grant Newsom, one of our regulars and favorite guests here at Securing America, also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, as well as a man with extensive and very distinguished background in both uniform and as a foreign service officer and as a business executive out in the East Asia theater. And Grant, I want to come to the substance of the book in terms of how you address this possibility that the calculation the Chinese make is that they do need to use physical force to achieve their objectives in Taiwan. Xi is making no bones about it, that he is prepared to do that. The military, as we've been talking about, has been getting ready for it for quite some time. And you participated in an important conversation recently, one of our series of webinars in the Committee on the Present Danger China, about the preparations that the Chinese are making with their civilian population as well for old-fashioned shooting war, not just the unrestricted pre-kinetic kind. Talk a little bit about how all of these, you know, various factors seem now to be converging to at least give them the option to attack, if not suggest that that decision has already been made.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, to have the option to attack. But that doesn't mean they're just sort of thinking about it. They actually are getting ready. So if the order is given, they can move very quickly. And I would suggest that we might not have all the notice that we expect. But they're doing things that don't get the attention, but deserve it, such as stockpiling agricultural products, food, stockpiling oil, just as fast as they've been buying it, just as fast as they can, as much as they can, for a few years now. They're building up their own energy production capacity, building coal plants just right and left. And it looks like a country that's getting ready for a fight. And there's been actually sort of leaks about local officials being told to be able to do certain things to get ready for it. They've changed some of the regulations or laws that allow them effectively to expand the size of the People's Liberation Army.
Well, one of the leaks, to be explicit about it, is an actual video that I think has been validated from Guangdong Province, China's largest province, strategically located as well as rich one, that showed party cadre and the military actively planning, as they put it, to move from normal to war. Mm-hmm. To get the population, the society, the resources of the province and so on ready for it. And presumably, like meetings were taking place elsewhere around the country at the same time, no?
That's right. It's just as you described. But also, if you listen to what Xi Jinping has been saying, he made a reference, this wasn't all that long ago, to the Korean War, how that one blow, that it was worth it. And that although China suffered mightily, it got China what it wanted, and absorbing that kind of punishment was worth it. And I don't think he was just talking about the past. I think it gives a sense of his thinking, and the idea being that if they do sort of go kinetic, if they do use force against Taiwan, that they realize there will be a powerful response from the free world, from Taiwan's friends, but that it's worth it. And China can absorb it and will come out of it better off, ultimately, at least in more able to reach their ultimate objective, which is regional world domination. So you have to listen to what these people say, and it does give you some pretty good ideas of what they intend to do. Of course, we do have a large constituency of that will dismiss all of this. It's just talk. It's just jabbering, and no need to worry. I know that Peel, among other things, the People's Liberation Army, they say, is not ready to go across the strait. It's not able to. They're not smart enough. They'll never be our equals. So how could they possibly do it? Well, the Chinese like to have their enemy thinking that. And I think we do need to be on our alert. But as you said, things do look ominous. I don't know if there's another way to put that.
I couldn't agree more. And especially ominous, Grant, is something that you sort of alluded to there. And that is, there's a lot of history in China. The Korean War is just one example of it. The waves of cannon fodder, basically, that were sent against American Marines and others in the course of that bitterly contested war. But in addition to that, Mao Zedong famously murdered, or I should say infamously murdered, tens of millions of his own countrymen and spoke openly about a willingness to do so to 100 million more if necessary as part of realizing his objectives, which included, I think, even going back to his day, defeating the United States. So this idea that a kinetic war is simply out of the question, and they're just, I think Gordon Chang has used the phrase empty fortress, sort of bluffing, a tradition in China, I guess, it misses a terribly serious point. They are prepared to sacrifice their people. They don't honestly give a fig about them, any of them at least. And in the service of the party and its ambitions, anything goes. No?
Well, there's probably a limit, but it's a much bigger limit than we could imagine or we could even take. So as I say, there is a limit, and particularly with so many only children and sort of when the only child's a guy, and if a guy's a soldier and he gets killed, that can cause some problems if enough of it happens. But as I said, the Chinese government, communists, will absorb a lot of punishment, or better said, let their citizens absorb a lot of punishment. The elite classes They're not going to suffer much, and that's where we should make them suffer, particularly losing their overseas assets, sending their relatives back, canceling their green cards, and exposing their corruption. If you make the pressure, the damage, something that the elites experience, that will have some effect, but they're willing to squander an awful lot of lives to get Taiwan. There is an upper limit, but it's pretty darn high. And when
let me drill down on that for a moment, Grant, because I think this is really important to factor into our calculations. You're right that the Chinese, as a result of their one-child policy, have created conditions under which a lot of families have one child. It's a male child. An awful lot of them are military-aged male children at that, and unmarried because there are no women for them. So those families have a keen interest in keeping them alive. They're the successor generation, of course. And yet the party, I think, probably looks at them as a problem. And cannon fodder is not a bad application for all of that manpower, especially with the possibilities of real societal upheaval, because there are no women for them. So I think you're absolutely right. This is a bit of a dynamic of popular opposition, perhaps, but a powerful interest on the part of the state to disregard it. And at the end of the day, though we saw in the recent white paper protests and so on, the party did respond to popular pressure, but by and large, it's proven to be pretty steeled against it, has it not?
Yes, that's correct. It takes an awful lot of pressure to bring the thing down, or to even make a shift, shift policies. As you described, it's a little hard to tell exactly how this plays out. China might want to get rid of, say, a few million of these so-called bear branches. That's what they call these young males that have no chance of finding a wife. They might not mind that and think they can handle, say, the protests by 3 million families. But 10 million families, maybe not. So say there's a limit to this, but it's a very high limit, and we have to get ready accordingly. But also we have to make it clear that if they do make a move, and that they are going to reach the high end of that pretty quickly. And that will affect the cost-benefit analysis from Beijing's perspective.
Yeah, but let me just put another sort of possible theory of the case. If those bare branches are going to be, if I can use the analogy, planted on foreign soil, where there may be a lot more women, but also strategic interests of the Chinese Communist Party to be served, invasion, in other words, around the world, that may not be such a bad outcome. The kids, most of them would survive as well as serve the state. And Grant, I guess the thing that is just so top of mind for me, and I know for you too, is when China attacks, as you put it, it is entirely possible, if not absolutely predictable, that what they will be doing is not just going to be operating themselves in their immediate region against Taiwan, but they will be operating certainly against our other friends and allies in the region. They will be operating, I think we agree, probably against us, and we'll talk more about that after a short break. But they're also going to be taking advantage of this colonial infrastructure they've been building all over the world, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, which lends itself to making a global conflict, something unlike anything we've seen before, a distinct possibility. We're going to come back and talk about that and more with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired author of When China Attacks, right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. TikTok CEO Zhu Jiechu will testify today before the House Energy Committee. According to a prepared statement, he'll tell lawmakers that his company, quote, ByteDance, is not an agent of China or any other country, unquote, and it stores, quote, American data on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel, unquote. In fact, like all Chinese and other companies doing business in China, ByteDance must work for the Chinese Communist Party. It does what it's told, including harvesting immense quantities of personal data from its users that the CCP weaponizes. But even if that were not so, there's no disputing the even more insidious feature of TikTok's toxically addictive platform. It is used by our mortal enemy to propagandize mostly young and impressionable American users to hate our country and admire communist China. Shut TikToks down. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We are continuing this really important conversation with one of the smartest guys we know on matters involving China and what its aspirations, at least those of Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, the emperor, now for life, who has made little secret of his expectation that he will return China to its rightful place in the world, the so-called Middle Kingdom. Dictating global governance, I think is his term of the moment, with Chinese characteristics. Grant Newsom, again, congratulations on the imminent publication of this new book, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. It is available for pre-order, folks, and I hope you will do that. Grant, just to pick up on the thought that we left off with there a moment ago, talk a little bit about what the Chinese have been doing to put into place not only this sort of colonial empire with which to dominate the world, but the vehicles that they've been building with, I think, our money, actually, payday loans and so on, in terms of rail networks, roadways, ports, airports, and the like, that are basically being designed from the ground up, as best I can tell, to be dual use, to be capable of supporting the People's Liberation Army and most, if not all, of those 147 some countries in the Belt and Road Initiative.
Well, that's exactly what's coming. And the Chinese have looked at how the U.S. military operates, and they see we have a network of airports and ports around the world, even some military facilities, but we have a lot of access to places and allows the American military to have a global presence. China wants to have the same thing. And this is part of the reason for the Belt and Road Initiative. And it works, it's worked very effectively so far, even though individual projects have not succeeded in many cases. But what it has done is used commercial presence to establish a physical presence with a lot of Chinese people coming in, Chinese businesses operating and dominating. That leads to political influence. And this infrastructure gets built up. And the next step will be militarization of it, where you have the PLA being able to come in and operate, in some cases stick around for a good long while. But before, and they're not at that point yet, because they haven't got the military part of it in many places at all, but it's coming. But even without that, you can cause an awful lot of trouble in a fight with your main enemy, the United States. One example, that Chinese companies control both ends of the Panama Canal. Just with a little imagination, you can cause some mischief and make it so the U.S. Navy can't get through it, U.S. cargo ships can't get through, and that's a big help. If you're fighting, you can use these facilities, say, to use your fishing fleet to go out, lay mines, operate drones, and once again, make life very difficult for the Americans and their friends. So you've already got some pretty good platforms from which to operate. But if you play it out 5-10 years, the infrastructure is being built, and that's what they intend to do. It's not a surprise to anyone.
Yeah, well, it will be a surprise to us when we start paying attention to it, I think. I have to tell you myself, when we did a study a little over a year ago, I guess now, grant of the Belt and Road Initiative, discovered that about 147 of the, whatever it is, 190 some countries in the world are already hooked up with the Chinese to varying degrees, to be sure. But some of them are really functionally enslaved by it, but some are still getting into the game. But I think some are beginning to have real regrets, especially when those payday loans are coming due and they're having to surrender certainly some of these assets, but in some cases, even their sovereignty apparently is in the contract. It goes over the side too. Grant, let's come back to the When China Attacks piece of this, because I think one of the things I've so valued about our conversations is you're very clear-eyed about the sorts of steps that are being taken by the Chinese to give them the option of kinetic operations. And we've just expanded those options globally, really. But one of the things you sort of alluded to a moment ago is we may not have the kind of indicators and warnings, as they say in the intelligence business, that things are going kinetic, that we rely upon to have the opportunity to prepare and stage forces, get through the Panama Canal, for example, or perhaps take control of it, for heaven's sakes. What you've described is it doesn't take a little imagination. I think these are the subjects of lots of detailed plans by the CCP in place today, ready to go at a moment's notice in Panama, for example. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the Chinese have got the military capability, the ability to move troops across the strait. They've also got helicopters they can operate that sort of are a relatively new development. People tend to say, well, in World War II, these assaults required this, this, and this. Well, in World War II, they didn't have helicopters. That vertical envelopment makes a big difference. These long-range precision weapons, which they've got a ton of, are very good. Their electronic warfare is good. The ability to say, cut communications, cut the internet, and isolate their target, they can do that as well. They've coastline, they've got the air and helicopter launch points. The railroads have all been brought down there and modernized, and they can move troops and hardware in very quickly. They practice, and they're very good at loading up ships and also using civilian ships. We think that we have to have these gray-hulled amphibious ships, purpose-built for the military. That's not how the Chinese see it. They have got hundreds, if not thousands, of commercial ferries, barges, that will work just fine. You only have to get across
once. Roll-off ships, as they're called, larger.
And they do practice putting military equipment, hardware on it. And if we're watching for their amphibious ships, and they're using their commercial ships for most of the movement, well, we just might miss something.
Preparations, for sure.
Yeah. So that's, that is, how they might actually be able to get things in place and move before we see it or we recognize it.
This is a key point. And when we come back after our final short break, we're going to talk to Grant Newsom about whether that extends to operations inside our country as well. And if so, what those would look like and what we best be doing about all of this with the author of When China Attacks, A Warning to America, Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. Stay tuned for more right after this. We're back for this concluding segment of a very special hour, highly informative and very thought-provoking, as it always is when we have a chance to visit with Colonel Grant Newsom, a very distinguished Marine veteran and man who has served his country in other capacities, including as a foreign service officer. He has, to his credit, some time in the business community as well in the Far East, and knows his way around the area very well. And Colonel, I wanted to sort of bring this home, if I could, quite literally. You sort of alluded to some of the things that could go sideways for us in areas of the world adjacent to us, fishing fleets and the like being weaponized against us. I'd like you just to do a thought experiment with me. One of the things that Donald Trump tried to do when in office was ensure that we did not have particularly hostile foreign nations' equipment in our electric grid. One of the first things that Joe Biden did was suspend that executive order, interestingly enough. And there are now 400 high-voltage Chinese-made transformers in our electric grid. You understand their order battle, their doctrine. Do you think there's any chance, Grant, that they have missed the possibility that they could perhaps, with a switch or an electronic signal at least, turn those transformers off, presumably for some time, with catastrophic effects on our grid, to say nothing of, mobilizing and moving forces? The entire society could be paralyzed. Could that possibly have occurred to the Chinese? And do you think they might exercise that option as part of when China attacks?
I'd be astonished if they hadn't thought of it, and I'd be astonished if they didn't use it. It's a very effective way to put us not just on the back foot, but to pretty much paralyze us. Think how we react when the power goes out for a little while. Even think about how you act when the Wi-Fi goes down. And this is much, much worse than that. So I would say,
especially if it's an enduring shutdown. It's one thing if it comes back in 24 hours, but
yeah, and this is really part of their. It's part of how they fight, and the scenario that I would imagine, and a lot of there's probably at least a dozen scenarios, and probably a lot more of how this could all play out. But I could see China learning the lessons from Russia's experience in Iraq and Ukraine, and going very hard and fast against Taiwan. Using amphibious assault, airborne assault, heavy use of missiles, cutting it off electronically, shutting down any satellites that are over Taiwan, and
block fifth columnists and
well, that's the next thing. And you've already got your fifth columnists in Taiwan. You've landed a lot of special forces. They cause all sorts of trouble, and then you do something. You tell the American administration, look, you stand clear. This is a domestic matter. If you do something, it's nuclear war. And you just might have an administration fold. And at the same time, you've done things like, as I said, you have mined, say, the Japanese ports out of which the U.S. Navy is going to come. U.S. Navy ships out of San Diego find that they're getting swarmed by drones and their communications are being shut down so they can't fight. Cyber attacks, it's you name it. These would be smallish things that you could see a certain type of administration saying, well, we don't know exactly who did it, so we don't want to risk nuclear war over a little island 90 miles from China. And that says one scenario, and they've won with a certain expenditure of use of force and expenditure of people and resources, but they haven't gone all out, and they have kept the Americans away, and that's the big thing. And you can imagine there'd be America's donor class after this happens saying, well, we got to keep doing business with them. How soon can we get back to normal? And so that's one scenario I could see happening.
That in a way is the best case, Grant, isn't it? Because if they decide that they don't want to risk their deterrent failing, they may decide they need to take those kinetic actions preemptively. Let me ask you quickly, we've got about 2 minutes left in this time. It's just flown by, as it always does with you, Grant. Just some concluding thoughts about what, given all of this, we need to do, not just if, but when China mm-hmm. attacks.
Okay, well, what we need to do, and I'll get to that, but first the book, and I just want to clear this up, that the title of the book is When China Attacks, and that can have two meanings. One is a future tense, the other is present tense. And my point is in the book that they already are attacking us. Psychological warfare, biological, chemical, economic, financial, proxy warfare, and they've been very effective, and they have really weakened us. Our military has not kept up with what it needs to do to be able to fight China. China's military has, in the meantime, really boomed. And with America funding China's growth, Wall Street and the business class, thank you very much.
Our money.
Well, that's exactly it. And so that's actually that's the meaning of this, the title. And I try to lay it all out, explain how it happens, what happens if we lose. And then there is a section on what do we do about it? Well, the first thing you do is recognize you're in a war with an enemy. We may not see it as a war, but they do. You have to and realize that it may not have a happy outcome for us. And then we have to go to work. You have got to shut off the economic and financial wherewithal, the support we've given the PRC. It's going to require sanctions, restrictions on what American and some of our other countries can do in the China market. We have to wean ourselves off of that insane dependency. So even some of our military supplies come from China. This is crazy. Pharmaceuticals as well. We've got ourselves addicted to the China market. We have to get over that. Additionally, we have to do propaganda again in the good original Jesuit meaning of it, which is explain yourself. And if we can't sell all the good things that America and our system has, we might as well give up now. But we used to know how to do this. We can do it again. Go after the Chinese on human rights, the corruption.
Delegitimate them, I think, is one of the key elements.
That's a good way. Delegitimize this government that they have. We have
to leave it at that. This is a great prescription and mm-hmm. a great book. We're so proud of you.
It's a splendid book.
More about it.
So anyway, here it is.
Take it from the author. It is a splendid book. Get it, folks, and come back to us again next time, mm-hmm. if you will, for more of Securing America. Till then, go forth and multiply.